Consequence Podcast Network.
I'm struggling to figure out a bit. I'm not sure what to do. I my mind is just blocked. Maybe I should find someone to dig into the deepest recesses of my mind to try to find something. I know. This is what you asked for.
Here, Clint, hold on. I'm going to take my vibrating magic mutant brain hand.
Oh,
and I'm
going
to put it to your forehead. And do you know what I'm going to hear back there clouding all that thought, preventing you from reaching your truest self? Do you know what I hear?
I don't know what you hear.
Fireball.
Damn you, Pitbull.
Featuring one of the all-time great lyrics, I saw, I came, I conquered. Or should I say, I saw, I conquered, I came. Come on.
Put it in the Smithsonian.
Welcome to TV Party. I'm Clint Worthington.
I'm Allison Shoemaker.
I'm Dominic Suzanne Mayer.
We've got a lot on our plate this episode. Later in the episode, we'll actually be swapping out Dom for Alex McLeavy from the AV Club. Sorry, Dom. To talk about the season 2 finale of Legion and our very complicated feelings about that and the season as a whole. But first, let's get into some news. A lot happened this week. First off, we'll sort of breeze past this, but AT&T just got authorized to close its merger with Time Warner. Warner, which is a really interesting step in our upcoming dystopia of mega corporations and just the increasing consolidation of telecom stuff. What do we think about this, guys?
So, I mean, I'll point out the obvious here. How this isn't a violation of antitrust law on a supreme level is completely beyond me. But hey, I'm just a filthy prole. What do I know?
And that's the nuances of this are sort of beyond us. But I don't know. In other news, Star Trek Discovery has actually already had another showrunner shakeup. Like at first, Brian Fuller ran it, and then he left before the season even aired. And then now, apparently a little bit into filming season 2, the showrunner who took over for him, Aaron Harberts and Gretchen Berg, they have left, and now Alex Kurtzman has taken over as showrunner. He's been around for almost the entirety of Discovery's process, so it's not like he's new, but it is really interesting. Apparently, the previous showrunners were running into things about allegations of staff mistreatment, like yelling at writers and other staff and misusing the budget and stuff. And, you know, I'm hoping that Kurtzman will come in and it'll be still feel like a consistent season, because that was Discovery's major problem, is that the first half and second halves felt like they were from two different showrunners.
Yeah, I gotta be honest. I feel like the things that are great about Discovery probably require a steady hand to continue.
Yeah.
I'm not sure this is the showrunner to provide that steady hand.
No.
I don't know. I'm worried.
Moving on, tied into our episode last week, where we talked about a bunch of Ryan Murphy stuff, we got a little bit of American Horror Story news. Apparently, season 8's going to have a crossover between Murder House and Coven, which is really interesting and exciting. They've only really done anything like that once before, where they had Lily Rabe's character from Asylum appear in an episode of Freak Show.
Well, there have been more crossovers than that. There are a couple of characters who've cropped up a couple of times. Twisty the Clown has now been in 2 seasons. The Pinhead has appeared in multiple seasons. The surviving Pinhead. Some others. So there's definitely room for that in this universe. What I am most interested in with regard to this is that people just, at least yesterday when this broke, Ryan Murphy tweeted it, seemed to be concerned that he was hacked because it didn't make sense. There was news earlier that Evan Peters was going to be playing a hairdresser. It's just like over and over again. Are you hacked? Did you get hacked?
That's freaking great.
Is this a hack? But I'm just very excited. I can't wait. Even if it's a mess, and of course it's going to be a mess, it's American Horror Story. The idea of those 2 seasons crossing over is particularly thrilling to me.
I'm especially interested in maybe seeing if the same actors will play different characters in their respective seasons in this crossover.
I would imagine that they'll probably find a way to just have them play one or the other. It's also possible that they could jump in time, right? Uh-huh. Like those two series are both supposed to be contemporary, but if somehow we're looking at the origins of Murder House, and then maybe it's one of the more ageless figures from Coven or something. Uh-huh. Who knows? But I'm very excited by the prospect. Dom, you share my fondness for Coven, don't you? Am I crazy?
Yes, and maybe it's going to sound petty, but when I read about this particular crossover, my immediate knee-jerk reaction was, oh, cool, the good seasons.
Hey, I've got a soft spot for Asylum.
Yeah, well, Asylum is, it seems to be the consensus best season, but I think these two are ripe for a combination. I'm very excited. Whatever, as long as Connie Britton's hair is involved... And as long as, obviously, I doubt we'll see Myrtle Snow, but if we can get some fucking Sarah Paulson in, like, high witch drag, or, like, some really catty Emma Roberts.
I need both Frances Conroys.
I really want to see Sarah Paulson as, like, the new Supreme.
Yeah, totally.
Sorry for 5-year spoilers, everyone.
Yeah, right.
Anyway.
Yeah, but that's exciting stuff. One thing we didn't have in the outline, but I think merits mention, is Jerry Springer is finally halting production after 27 years, where its future is uncertain. I didn't know it was still on, but apparently only just now. I think maybe it's on the CW, and now it's going to the CW for repeats, but I was just like, the show's still on, and it's only just now, like, in limbo, apparently?
Well, first of all, this is more proof that, like, Maury Povich will outlive us all. But also, like, this is the end of an era, because this heralds, in a sense, like, the true death of 90s shock television.
The last one to bite the dust. And in much dumber, more regressive news, I'm really sad about Millie Bobby Brown, leaving Twitter over being, like, harassed. That was also really crappy. The thing that broke today that we sort of have to at least, like, briefly talk about, there was a Medium post from
Chloe Dykstra.
Yeah, that was, Chloe Dykstra, who's a cosplayer, in a Medium post talking about a relationship of hers where the person was not named, but this is a man who's like 20 years her senior, and details the very frightening, very sort of traumatic relationship that they had. But it is strongly implied that it is Chris Hardwick. And we're already seeing the fallout, like, sort of in real time as we record this, and it's really sort of interesting to experience.
We should also say Chloe Dykstra is also an actor and a writer. It's an extremely upsetting read if you are a person who has ever been in a relationship that is physically or emotionally abusive, certainly sexually abusive. You may or may not want to read it. Nerdist has sort of swiftly made it clear that they're no longer tied to Chris Hardwick. I think he sold the brand in like 2011. His podcast isn't there anymore, but they took really quick action to make it clear that they were no longer associated with him, which I think is both a smart PR move, but also the right thing to do, knowing that there could be blowback from his fan base, which is not insignificant.
Yeah.
Inconsiderable, I should say. But yeah, I mean, he obviously, is, at the time we're recording, has yet to respond. The post itself, she does talk about writing it for herself and for her own healing and to be honest about her experience as a survivor, and mentions not wanting to damage him, but hoping that the person that he has become will respond rather than the person that he was, who seems to be, frankly, a monster. It's it's a very upsetting read.
It's behavior that's beyond the pale, and it's just, it's horrifying.
Yeah, I mean, it's a behavior that is illegal. It's like...
absolutely.
Yeah, it's abusive. There's there is very little recourse for anyone suffering... legal recourse anyway, from anyone suffering emotional or verbal abuse, little for physical abuse, and Almost in no situation is anyone ever prosecuted or taken to task at all for rape when the partner, when the person being raped is their significant other. So it's horrible. And I want to commend her for writing so candidly and beautifully. It's a beautiful piece of writing, but for speaking so candidly about her experience. And yeah, the world is garbage. How about that?
But hopefully the purge of terrible men continues, so at least there, we can take some small comfort in that. Well, let's end our news on a brighter note, though. Something we literally just found out right before recording. I'm happy to announce this as the patron saint of lost TV causes. Lucifer, the cult show from Fox, just found a new home at Netflix.
Yeah, friend of the show, sometime contributor to Consequence of Sound and all around great writer in person, LaToya Ferguson covers Lucifer for the AV Club. Well, it was covered. And the reason I saw this is a minute after the story broke, she had tweeted it and it just said, "What the fuck?" So I am excited for LaToya, who assures me that Lucifer has gotten very good recently. Maybe this is the push I need to get me to revisit.
That's been sort of a, again, like a regular story. I mean, you know me banging the drum about The Expanse, and then like that one day process of rescuing Brooklyn Nine-Nine from cancellation. So like, in terms of at least like rescuing cult favorite TV shows that maybe just for whatever reason weren't getting the audience or the pull from networks that they should, getting them a second life, which is really cool. So now that we have the news out of the way, let's talk about our picks of the week. Allison, why don't you start with what's your favorite stuff for the last week?
I was very excited about the return of The Bold Type, which we've talked about a little on the show. I think it was my anticipated pick for last week. I know we talked about it in our summer TV preview. The Bold Type is a series on Freeform. It is about three young women who are working at, well, two of them now working at a fashion magazine that's somewhere between Cosmopolitan and Elle, basically. It's based on the life of Joanna Coles, who is one of the founders of Cosmopolitan, but very loosely based. It's a show that feels utterly of the moment, taps in really intelligently now, it didn't at first, into what it is actually like to be someone who is working in media right now. There are lots of conversations about clickability and virality and social media and how you tell a story with nuance in an era in which nuance is often disregarded. It features three great central performances and one of my favorite supporting performances on all of TV, Melora Hardin, who plays the editor-in-chief of Scarlet, this magazine. And when you meet her, you think she's going to be a Miranda Priestly figure. She's always wearing incredibly fabulous shoes and really sharp pantsuits. And you're like, oh, right, Miranda Priestly, this woman is going to be a nightmare. But because the Bold Type is really good and smart, instead, she's the boss that you've dreamed about your whole life but never had. She's a thoughtful, compassionate, focused, not too weepy, not too touchy-feely, but like really incredible woman. And she treats her staff accordingly. And it is just great. So it came back this week with a two-part premiere. The episodes are Feminist Army and Rose-Colored Glasses, in which the show, which now is a new showrunner, it's the woman who ran Sweet Vicious, which was a far too short-lived series on MTV. It finally, after a season of just pretending it wasn't even true, started to address the fact that one of these three characters, Kat, is biracial. She's Black. There was a particularly silly, not silly, that's not the right word, but misguided episode in the first season when the woman that Kat is dating, Adina, a Muslim lesbian photographer, ends up in an altercation with the police. And Kat, well, it's with like a passerby, and Kat tries to stand up for her. She ends up clocking a guy. As a result, the cops are called and Adina runs. And Kat is really pissed about it, but the episode ends up being about how this woman can't afford to be in a situation where someone could try to take away her green card or throw her in prison, and it's risky. But the show never acknowledges that as a Black woman, Kat would also be at risk in that situation. Like, she has an interaction with the police and race never comes up. Her own race never comes up. It was wild. So in these episodes, they finally started to address that, particularly in Rose-Colored Glasses, in a really effective way. Two female characters had oral sex on television, and it was handled really tastefully. And there was a conversation about nerves and discomfort, and it was fucking wonderful, and the Bold Type is great. So please watch the Bold Type. This week's episode, and when you're hearing it, it'll be last week's episode of Westworld, was also terrific. But next week on the show, I'm going to be out, but Clint is going to be joined by two of our very favorite people to talk about this season of Westworld as a whole. So I'm going to leave that episode for them to dig into.
I'm really, really looking forward to talking about that episode. It blew me away.
Yeah,
it's
it
so
was
fantastic.
Amazing.
Dom, what about you? What's your picks?
So for the past week, first, I want to jump into the show that, thanks to you, Clint, will only ever be Strangel in my head until forever.
Here's the thing. I'm positive you said it first, and I was just repeating it back to you.
I don't know anymore. Like,
but I'll take the credit. You know what? I'll take it.
I don't know how this came into being, but the CBS All Access show, Strange Angel, is one of my picks because I have Cheap Pop Time, an article about it up at Consequences Sound right now, where I talk about the first three episodes that were made available to the press initially. And of those three episodes, I'm intrigued by the show so far. It has a really interesting, very Mad Men reminiscent tone of subversion within the auspices of 40s culture. And at the same time, I want it to get weirder for sure, because if I read ahead, admittedly, and someone watching the show may or may not wish to, but the story of Jack Parsons is so sublimely weird that if this is only going to be a limited series, which I think it's in that limbo that every first season of a TV show kind of is now. But if this ends up being a limited series, they have a lot of craziness to get to really quickly. Because I can say, three episodes in, they haven't gotten to any of his connections with L. Ron Hubbard yet, just for starters.
Huh.
So
interesting.
I'm really excited to check this one.
So it's very interesting. And David Lowery directed the pilot. He's helmed A Ghost Story and Pete's Dragon in recent years. And I really dug his work on it because it does a good job of foregrounding the inner dreams and the cultural repression of the time within these people in a way that feels authentic to them and not necessarily hokey like it could very easily. I wanted to say, so if Strange Angel is my TV pick of the week, my TV pick of the week, the year, possibly the decade, is the Drake music video for I'm Upset. Now, you might be sitting here saying, but Dominic, you're on a TV podcast. Why are you talking about the embarrassing diss track that Drake actually named I'm Upset? Because he did. I'm here talking about it because Drake, in an effort to quash all of the memes of Pusha T assuming the guise of Rick, who, for all of you Degrassi The Next Generation fans out there like me, I could probably just about lead the fan club. Rick was the assailant whose violent shooting put Jimmy Brooks, a.k.a. the one-time Aubrey Graham, a.k.a. Drake. Never forget that he was Aubrey Graham and billed like fifth. Now he's one of the biggest rappers in the world. But anyway, so he reunited the cast of early aughts Degrassi for the I'm Upset video and shot the video in Degrassi High. As far as responses to fanged insults go, it has to be one of my favorites ever.
That's amazing.
Also, it's very fun to come around full circle and realize everyone you had a crush on at 13 is someone you still have a crush on. So thanks, Drake.
That's always a nice feeling. All right. Well, my picks, I've got a couple picks that I'll do, and then like I'll stay on brand as well. But I want to talk about the Tonys real quick, because we had the Tonys were just this last weekend, and it was actually a pretty good Tonys. I mean, Josh Brogan and Sarah Bareilles were great hosts. They made the most of their significant talents. The theme was really consistent, you know, the idea of Tony dreaming and all the little Instagram pictures of everyone's first roles. And I thought it was a really accessible way to make the Tonys inoffensive, but also powerful in certain personal ways. There's no better case for that than when they actually brought the drama department from Stoneman Douglas High School in, along with the teacher who risked her life to keep them safe during that tragic shooting and having them sing Seasons of Love. Like, as soon as the opening piano bars hit of that, I was like, oh no, oh my God, are they going to do this right now? My heart is going to be in pieces. And it was.
As a person who has watched every Tony's since, God, I was a kid, I think. Well, I definitely watched them all when I was a kid. I'm not sure that I caught them all when I first moved to Chicago, but I'm one of those big Broadway nerds, so I've seen them all. I also once went to a Tony's dress rehearsal. That was the year that, what's his face? Which 80s dick from rock and roll music beamed his head during the Tonys? Somebody from fucking Rock of Ages. Anyway, some asshole who dicked around during rehearsal and then in the actual live performance hit his head on a fly because he couldn't be bothered to rehearse properly. It was great. Whatever, he's fine.
right.
Anyway, I think it was a great Tony's. It's a huge improvement from last year when Kevin Spacey was hosting.
Yeah, I was real glad they didn't feel the need to address that this year, too. That would have cast a pall over the whole thing.
But Sarah Bareilles and Josh Groban were really game. They are friends in real life, and you could tell. They just had a really easy rapport. Bareilles wrote a very charming opening number that I've had stuck in my head since last Sunday for the people who lose, basically, for everybody who gets nominated and doesn't win. And they played it on two pianos and had some in-song banter about how neither of them has ever won anything. It was great.
And then the opening sequence ends with bringing on ensemble members from all the nominated shows to sing, which is great. Yeah.
It was just great. It was also really fun to watch the band's visit, an intimate musical based on an Israeli movie. Basically sweep. It was the big story of the evening. Not Harry Potter, not SpongeBob, which is great, by the way. Not any of the big flashier things, but this tiny little musical with David Yazbek musical with Tony Shalhoub in it. It was pretty cool. But yeah, I should also say that if you were excited about that Tony's and about the teacher from Stoneman Douglas getting an honorary Tony, you should know that they do that every year. It's hard to imagine a more moving recipient because she literally barred the door and kept... Yes, it kept 20 of her students safe. But the Tony Awards give an award every year to a high school drama teacher, or I guess I should say a drama teacher. I'm not sure it's always high school, but somebody who teaches theater to kids. It's one of my very favorite parts of the show. And if you, like me, had a great drama teacher when you were young, consider nominating them because it's really special.
Yeah, absolutely.
Oscars should do that. Come on, get it together, Oscars.
Come on. But also on Netflix, I've also been watching a little bit of The Staircase, which I actually didn't know when I first started watching. It was actually made in 2004. It's a French television miniseries, but it's about the trial of Michael Peterson, who was accused of murdering his wife, Kathleen, in this very mysterious incident where she was found at the bottom of the staircase and there was a 911 call. And it's very much in the making a murderer sort of style of investigative journalism or of documentary that Netflix is going towards. And the reason it's on Netflix now sort of getting released is that they added, I think, 4 new episodes to the end to, I think, total about 13 episodes. So it's about 13 hours of television. So of course I haven't finished all of it, but I'm a few episodes in, and even in the parts that are, you know, a decade and a half old, that are as old as The Incredibles, mind you, it's really intriguing. Like a lot of good true crime docs, I'm into it. And I wasn't going to talk about this, but I have to call an audible. I'm talking about The Expanse. I'm really sorry. Like, I'm a broken record, but every episode keeps getting better. And this most recent episode called Dandelion Sky has actually blown the lid off a season that has already been phenomenal. They're getting to the mystery of this mysterious ring that's appeared that may be of alien origin. Seasons long dead characters are reappearing as ghosts in the main character's mind. By the end of the episode, The Expanse goes full 2001 A Space Odyssey, and we have 3 episodes left in the season. So I'm curious and fascinated as to like where they'll even go from here, because I think like this maybe like the entirety of the third book in microcosm in like 7 episodes. So a lot is happening in each episode, but they're still managing to like keep the tone really nice, and the pacing is great and quick, and Elizabeth Mitchell is killing it as a religious character in a sci-fi show, which is rare to actually pull off. Yeah, it's just great. I can't get enough of The Expanse, and I can't wait for other people on this podcast to listen to so that they don't have to just hear me blather on by myself. But now that we've ended our episodes of the week, we should get on to the business at hand of our Bachelorette haikus, shan't we, Allison?
Oh, we shall. You go first.
Oh, okay, I'll go first. I have two. David bonks his face, and football breaks poor Clay's wrist. Body count rises. How many more lives will the Bachelorette take?
Okay, hit me with number two.
All right. Wait, is that the end? Where's the rose ceremony? Just do the damn thing.
I thought that was weird, too. Why wasn't there a rose ceremony?
I guess there were enough casualties that they're like, oh, this counts. All right, anyway. Yes, Allison, your turn.
Okay. Falling out of bed. Looks like he fought off a bear. Jordan's not a bear.
By the way, and we talked about this too. I am livid that the commercials all did this really obnoxious lead up to like Jordan punching out David, and that's why he's in the hospital, complete with like dramatic cuts to the ambulance and everything. And no, he just bonked his face. Anyways, The Bachelorette. I didn't anticipate 3 weeks ago getting this invested in the goddamn Bachelorette.
Well, what can you do?
What have you done to me? Dom, if it's all the same to you, we're going to swap you out with another guest as we talk about Legion.
Yeah, edge out of the way. Like if you go around the corner a little. Yeah.
I'd like to imagine that I'm doing the end of Infinity War thing as we speak.
Well, we'll have to on Infinity War you after we're done talking about Legion.
Yes, just put this like wicker basket over your head.
I don't feel so good.
Oh, God. All right, well, we'll take a quick break and then we'll be back with some Legion chat.
Well, now that we have our episodes of the week out of the way, it's time to get down to business. We're here for a very, very intriguing discussion, I'm sure, on the second season of Legion, which just had its finale this past week. It's Noah Hawley's superhero show for Marvel from FX. Had a very solid, interesting first season. What did we think of the second season? And we're actually here with a very special guest, Alex McClavey from the AV Club. Say hello, Alex.
Hey, Clint.
Hello. You know, you've been covering Legion this second season for AV Club, right? What have been your thoughts for the season?
I've been covering it now two seasons straight. The second season was a fascinating one to me for a lot of reasons, but mostly because it was such an interesting experiment, I thought, in terms of trying to do something very sort of weird and avant-garde in terms of narrative structure and particularly emotional structure by making a show where it's very hard to relate to anybody and you can't really get your bearings with anyone. That's really the opposite of what most shows do, where even if there's an anti-hero, they really give you their point of view. They let you inside their head. They let you know what they're feeling, thinking, all that. And Legion sort of, especially season two, has been so focused, I think, on doing the exact opposite.
Yeah, almost in a contrarian fashion, where it feels like, oh, here's a noted convention. Like, no matter how sound it is, like, we're just going to subvert it for subversion's sake.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think it's interesting to see a show do that and be so committed to this idea of, you know, telling, I think, you know, to its credit, I think in many ways telling a very straightforward story, but doing it in the most elliptical fashion possible and without any of the normal narrative, you know, I guess if you're being, you know, harsh, call them narrative crutches, or if you're being sympathetic, you'd call them reliable, time-tested ways of telling stories.
Yeah, that's very true. Allison, what did you think of the season? I mean, you wrote a piece recently for Consequence of Sound on the finale. Both of you have written on the finale.
I am very frustrated by this season overall. I think it started out in a really exciting place. It had some of the same drawbacks that I had to the first season. It often, I think, sacrifice particularly character development for style or occasionally for shock. But for the most part, I think the first, I don't know, five or six, maybe seven episodes were very interesting. And then it sort of started to fall apart for me round about the time that there's the big revelation that Lenny's return is necessitated by the murder, or perhaps not murder, it's not really clear, of Amy, David's sister. And from that point on, it became harder and harder for me to stay engaged. Certainly became harder for me to care about the characters. Not all of them. I think that some of the performances and the supporting cast are strong enough to make up for the fact that the writing is a little bit undercooked in places. And then ending on a note that was so sour and, to me, so poorly thought out and poorly drawn that I'm having a hard time imagining returning for season three, honestly, which is not something I imagine saying at the beginning of the season. Those first, I think it was four episodes that were released to critics beforehand. Clint and I both did sort of pre-air reviews for the site. Clint's focused on dance and mine on sort of the visual storytelling. And those were very positive. And man, did the wheels come off the wagon for me as yeah. we rounded into the home stretch.
Well, that's another thing. Fascinatingly enough, after that pre-air, I mostly did it based on like the episodes that were released for critics. And then I stopped watching. And then I realized that we talked about doing Legion for this episode and I mainlined it. And it's a really interesting experience binging season two of Legion because, I mean, just due to its dreamlike nature and like the very, like you said, the elliptical nature of the plot progression and everything, it does become very difficult to keep track of what is going on, even when you're like trying to maintain focus throughout hours and hours and hours of the program. So yeah, I started out very positive like you did. And then yeah, those last four episodes really take a bizarre turn in some really distasteful directions.
Yeah.
But yeah, very frustrating. And I think there's nowhere better to start with that frustration than the finale. The finale just aired. What did we think about it, guys?
Oh boy,
is there a certain Pete Campbell quote that would summarize our feelings on the finale?
I mean, the thing is, and I was actually somewhat of a defender of the finale right up until we learn what we learn, I think is a good way to put it, right? Because they're doing some very interesting stuff to kick it off. There's that great, wonderful musical fight sequence between David and Farouk that kicks off the episode. There's a whole wonderful thread about that I think isn't wrong. And I like the impetus that they had to push towards this idea of turning a hero into a villain. I mean, it's a very sort of standard, it's a very classic anti-hero-ish move that they wanted to pull the rug out from under us in that way. But to do it in this way, where halfway through the episode, right, you suddenly realize that the protagonist of this show has sexually assaulted the other main character, who is his girlfriend, is one of those just needle scratch on the record moments that I don't think the show thought through well enough and certainly didn't execute well enough to earn in any way, shape, or form. And I know, Allison, we've talked about this a little before, and I think you're more or less on the same page with me in terms of that.
To me, it just seems like a conversation that was had in which absolutely no women were consulted, because it really feels like, ooh, what would be a really villainous thing? What could David do that would be so villainous that then he's definitely the villain and it's all about whether he's the hero or the villain, without actually taking into account the emotional experience and what that's going to mean for the story going forward, whether or not it is ever possible to align with David again after something like that. It feels as though these weren't questions that were asked, as though no one said, perhaps we should talk about what this is actually going to mean, what it's going to do to viewers, the experience it's going to put them through, and what it says for the show going forward. I can't say that for sure. I do not know the makeup of Legion's writer's room. Most of the episodes in this season are credited to either Nathaniel Halpern or Noah Hawley or a combination. But there's another episode credited to someone else, and I'm afraid I don't remember their name. But for the most part, it's those two. But that's what it felt like to me. And it's difficult for me to imagine coming back to the show in a sort of Breaking Bad kind of way, where everybody has a different point at which they decide Walt is the villain. Some people view him as a villain right away, and some people it took all the way until he's poisoning the kid. And it's, I can't see having that conversation, because I can't imagine journey for David that's going to be anywhere near as thoughtful or deliberate as this is going to require, in order for people to really engage again, at least for me to engage again. Does that make sense?
No, totally. It rings to me like that moment was just I believe that decision to be incredibly tone deaf, especially right now. Like, I mean, and always, but yeah, it was just, it felt cheap. It felt like a really cheap way to play with the audience's sympathies by going for the jugular in a way that the show doesn't merit and it doesn't set up. And I mean, there's maybe a way you could more intelligently pull the hero becoming a villain thing, but you can't wait until the penultimate episode of the season to start setting it up, if that makes sense. If you're going to try to sell this complete reversal of the character's sympathies, like, you have to lay the groundwork in a better way, and B, in a more sort of drawn out way. It can't just come out of left field
And not only that, right, but this idea that the show can sort of spend all season, you know, having all sorts of fun dealing with these sort of heady dorm room philosophy ideas of, like, truth and reality and the nature of truth and competing truths and competing realities and how do these things come to exist, and then throw sexual assault in there and be like, eh? Maybe there are multiple truths here.
Hmm? Nope. Yeah, like to lump that in with the rest of the sort of the dime store abstractions that the show has been peddling, it just feels really icky.
I read an infuriating interview with Noah Hawley that Vulture ran. It's very interesting. I absolutely recommend reading it because it's a glimpse into sort of what they were going for, as much as he'll say about what they were going for, that absolutely blew my mind, because what he describes, first of all, there's definitely some conversation about, like, well, consent is essential. There can't ever be a situation where someone doesn't consent, which is true. Absolutely true. So noted. But the rest of their conversation, so much of it seems to be about, well, maybe this means that Sid is actually the hero. And what if this whole time Sid has been the hero instead of David? And I find it frankly insulting. Sid is incredibly underdeveloped as a character. Many of the characters are underdeveloped, but the female characters in particular, I'm not sure there's a more underdeveloped character on the show than Amy, for example, which is part of why the back half of the season worked mostly unsuccessfully for me.
Although Tonami is a close second, I would argue.
Absolutely.
I legit, like, near the end, I'm like, wait a minute, what happened to Potonomy?
I guess he's still in the mainframe?
Just hanging out in the mainframe,
Banging on the walls of the Matrix, I guess.
But Sid, the show sort of gestures this season at her inner depths without ever really investigating him. They sort of pretend they're showing us and actually tell us what is going on inside her mind, her thoughts about love, her thoughts about survival, and it all doesn't add up to much. And the idea that somehow the whole time we thought she was just the love interest when in reality she's actually the show's hero, and that it's going to return next season and suddenly it's going to be centered on Sid the hero while David is the villain, is it just insulting. Like, I've been watching the show. I watched the show. I paid attention to the show. I thought about a lot about the show. I defended the show quite frequently, specifically to other women who watch television, and it just, like, there's no way that they actually thought, well, really, the whole time, Sid has been the hero of the show. They just thought it would be cool to suggest that now.
Yeah, that's a crock of shit.
It's just, oh, it made me so mad.
But let's go back to, like, the first half of the episode, because I do agree with you, Alex, at least, like, the first few minutes, like, that set piece as part of Legion's formal experimentation and playfulness there, I think, is really fun. So, I mean, like, the episode started off on a decent note for me. But yeah, then, like, those turns happen and it's pretty
bad. Yeah, exactly. Like, I was pretty convinced that they were going to at least stick the landing for a good portion of this episode. To bring it back sort of to the idea that the way that David becomes a villain is through this whole sort of, you know, thing they've set up all season long, of which, you know, I haven't been the biggest fan of the John Hamm voiceover, you know, educational segments, you know, after school special areas. But I do think they certainly did an efficient job in terms of establishing themes for the season of, like, you know, how do false narratives get established? How does mass psychosis happen? How do collective amnesia, collective dislogic, how do these things take place? And had it ended simply, with that being the case where, you know, Farouk whispers into that little mouse's ear, the mouse goes and whispers into everybody else's ear, and we have this genuine question of whether David is or isn't a villain, I think that would have been a much more interesting, much more ambiguous place to end the show on. But instead, they go and throw in this very painful, very all-too-traumatic real-world violence, and it completely upends any point they were trying to make or any sort of, you know, I think it really shreds a lot of this whole competing realities philosophy they've been doing all season long.
Yeah, and there, you know, there's an argument to be made also that they could have at least had David wrestle with maybe unknowingly, like, early, like the consequences of feeling, of like not realizing what he did. But basically what happens is he just mutters to himself, I'm a human being, I deserve love. And it just effectively, narratively throws his hands in the air and flips the table and says, well, fuck all you guys. It smacks of this like really pernicious, vicious, like resentment. So like his heel turn is just a tantrum, it feels like to me. And it's just really, it makes the whole thing, it gives the whole thing bad taste.
Yeah, I mean, I would say it, not only that, you know, I mean, I generally do think you could excise that whole sequence or that whole disastrous pivot, and the whole show would be better for it, but, and work actually much more effectively as a narrative. But not only that, I think Legion thinks it's earned the right to sort of tell this story of like, you know, whatever you want to call it, toxic masculinity, when it hasn't at all. There's a way that you could, that a show could do a very, you know, serious, nuanced look at the way that got, you know, men who think they're good guys are actually bad guys. This is not the, you know, the show where we have kung fu fights set to Jane's Addiction is not that show.
Right. And also, if you're going to tell that story, write the women better.
Yeah.
Honestly. Yeah.
Well, there's this very minor thing that's going on near the end, too, where it's suggested that Lenny is in love with David. And at first I thought it was just maybe a fascination thing and they just weren't particularly executing it well. But the moment when they're escaping, just in the closing moments of the finale, and she asks, what about Blondie? And it just seems to be also taking the character that I would argue is the best developed in the female character in the series that's the best developed and finding a way to center that on David too. Like now that relationship is also going to be all about David. It's not going to be about the fact that she's been held prisoner in someone else's mind and used like a puppet, which is another form of assault, by the way. And instead that one is also going to be all about David. All of the women in the show are going to be based exclusively on their relationships to the men in the show. Like we're really going to do that. All of them. There is sort of one exception, and I'm excited to talk about that because I think Alex is going to talk about the Loudermilk in a couple minutes here. But with that exception, I find it very disappointing. Sort of personally, it's not great to take a show personally, but Legion, I believed in you. And here we are.
Well, it's a show that purports to challenge you in ways that you would implicitly reward you for following along. And by the end of the season, it just kind of feels like you've been tricked. And I feel like the show sets itself up to with its own little defense mechanism of like, well, if you didn't like it, you just didn't get it, man. You don't know what we're going for. And I'm like, no, you can't just abstract your way into shitty situations and then, you know, justify it. I do agree with you though. Like it is kind of obnoxious how much the show revolves around David and how every single character revolves around David to the detriment of their own development. I mean, I think the prison cell he's put in is a pretty potent metaphor for the show itself, where he's the nucleus of this atom and everything else is sort of like flitting around him like electrons.
Which, you know, that wouldn't be such a problem if the other electrons were finally wrought. You know what I mean? But they're not. Many of the characters are, as I've said, severely underdeveloped. And it ends up underlining that when they just continue to return to the same point of view. I'm not arguing that Legion needs to have 12 protagonists. I'm certainly not saying that every TV show needs to have characters, each of which is drawn very thoroughly with their own wants and needs and desires. We can't all be the leftovers. We can't all be the Americans. That's not this story, and I wouldn't want it to be. But in centering everyone around David and doing very little to define some of those characters except by their relationship to David, it peels back that, like, I felt a lot like pay no attention to that man behind the curtain with this episode. It really felt like finally it was exposing how poorly thought out some of these decisions have been and how little there sometimes is to back up the admittedly and laudably daring and thrilling visual landscape that Holly and company have created.
Yeah, I think that's a good way of articulating it, right? This idea that sort of, you know, and speaking as somebody who I think, you know, has similarly, like you, defended a lot of this season to people, mostly because, you know, a lot of the criticism, I think, made by very smart people is that it's all flash and no substance. And first of all, you know, I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing in and of itself. There's a good place for flash in this world, and, you know, the show does...
Sometimes the style can be the substance.
Yeah, but exactly. And while I don't think that's entirely true with Legion, I think there's more going on under the surface than people give it credit for. I freely admit that this... Yeah, I think this finale sort of revealed that it was purely in the realm of abstract ideas, and that what we previously thought was sort of marginalization of characters, maybe for reasons of, you know, storytelling audacity or whatever, actually has been exposed as sort of a real gaping lack of character development.
Yeah, it feels kind of similar to Mr. Robot in that respect, where I feel like the second, like, they're both very formally daring shows with really complicatedly icky male protagonists whose second seasons really showed the cracks in their storytelling. But like you said, the visuals, I think, are the least impeachable part about it. And maybe that's a good chance for us to talk about the visuals. Do we have any, like, I mean, it's a season full of great images. Like, that's one of the interesting things about Legion, is that it feels like every single shot is so Kubrickian and modernist and, you know, so formally daring. Do we have any, like, particular favorite images throughout the season? Like, anything that popped out to us?
I still maintain that one of the smartest little tweaks one of the smartest little moments in the season two premiere is sort of, they're twins. One is when we first see the pool in Farouk's mind, in which we have both Oliver and Lenny looking very glamorous, laying on these floats, seemingly in paradise. They suddenly realize they're out of booze, and a drink appears at Oliver's side, and all we see is the hand of a butler, presumably standing in water, handing him this cocktail, and then the person has vanished. And then, I don't know, 40 minutes later, we're in the delightfully strange sushi conveyor belt restaurant that happens to be the cafeteria at the center. Oh, I love it so much. And dishes, again, seemingly appear out of nowhere. I'm thinking in particular of the ice cream scene, where they just sort of appear, and it's a very smart way of reminding us that, and without having to go big and without having to have John Hamm explain it, that we don't actually know what's real in this world, and you have to watch and follow to determine any sort of semblance of a sense of reality. And I think ultimately that when Legion pulls this off, it can be really transfixing. And those little tiny moments are among my favorite. But I'm also a huge fan of the bathtub drain stopper in the desert. That made me laugh out loud. I thought that was great.
Yeah, I mean, I agree that I think that, you know, that first episode really set up the visual, you know, aesthetic of this season so well, with so many of those great little flourishes. I had a ball watching that episode. The other one for me that really did a wonderful job of sort of harkening back to, I think, what was so great about the first season as well, as the third episode of season two, where David, you know, enters the minds of his fellow Division III, you know, buddies to rescue them from the illness, right? We've got Ptonomy, whose mind we go into. We've got Melanie, whose mind we've go into. I mean, I thought this was a great, a wonderful sequence here, or a series of sequences, where we get, again, what I think makes the show so visually arresting is these sort of anything can happen, we're inside someone's mind moments. For me, it was particular, you know, the cut to when we're inside Melanie's mind and we've just got that, like, text-based computer game going on around them. and we just, you know, Dave just typing into that computer and things happening as they go. I thought that was wonderful.
Yeah, same here. I would say if there was like a recurring visual image that I just really, really love, that sort of interpretive dance look of the Vermilions and Admiral Fukuyama, like I just, there's something very kind of almost Klaus Nomi about these like still women in similar sort of Uma Thurman Bob haircuts with big bushy mustaches speaking in vocoder autotune, connected by wire to this old Japanese man with a basket on his head. It's a really, really intriguing image. It was great that was one of the more, that they, those became like regular characters in the show.
Yeah, absolutely. Every time Vermilion showed up, I was happy.
Yeah, exactly. Even though thinking about it a little bit more, maybe it's a bit more of an indicator at Legion's use of women as props. So there is that. But yeah, there's that. And I even, you know, as sort of hokey as the John Hamm, or hammy maybe, as the John Hamm sequences were. I know, welcome to the world of TV Party where I make terrible puns. But I liked the almost Dogville way that they would visualize the, like the spread of a nocebo effect and everything else, like in that white almost construct from the Matrix world. And I don't know, the way they visualized and stylized that was really neat.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting to me because I thought that and sort of Vermilion were sort of flip sides of the same coin for me, whereas every time Vermilion appeared, I thought it sort of got richer and more interesting right up until that final fight between Vermilion and the Minotaur. For me, the Hamm's monologues, you know, sort of after school special moments were, you know, started off great and to me got progressively a series of...
Yeah, hey guys, did you know that there are fake news?
That one. By the time the internet...
Yeah,
one,
yikes. Oh.
Yeah, that was bad. I thought that the motif of the delusion of the sort of grotesque, oily baby bird was terrific, and the little trails it would leave everywhere, really, really smart. I think it ended up lasting way too long. They went to that well too many times, but it was great. And I started off really, really high on those Hamm monologues, if only because that's the voice of Don Draper, so how can we trust anything that he says?
Like, and we are being really sold this idea, yeah.
Totally. But God, yeah, specifically the internet one. By the time we got there, it was like,
gag me with
holy
a spoon.
Crap! Please, can we just tell a story? Like, anything, any relationship, anything at all, please? I'm starving.
Yeah, like, do you think you're telling us anything we don't know?
I like the idea. I like the description of it as dorm room.
Yeah, that is very good.
That's sure how
yeah, absolutely. Another great image I think is Lenny's cell when she comes back. That upside down, or is it kind of cell, and the way it's revealed with that upside down camera, and then Clark comes in, and then the camera tilts, and it's such a disorienting place, and it feels like such. It reminded me of the asylum from season one, just something so innately Legion.
I will say, I don't think there's anything in this season that freaked me out anywhere near as much as Aubrey Plaza's blue contacts. Just did not look right. It was so obviously wrong that every time I looked at her, I was like, oh God, this is giving me the squicks.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Is there any other visual motifs that like we really, really liked? Legion seems like such an original, unique, formal vision, but you can see the influences, right? Everything from Kubrick to everything else. I was actually making a bit of a list on like the film homages that I kept seeing throughout. Like there's absolutely the Clockwork Orange reference for like homeless David in that alternate world where the droogs are beating him up, and the finale fight reminded me of Big Trouble in Little China for sure. And in the finale, that like little tape where it's Jemaine Clement and Amy Smart just talking about their relationship reminded me of When Harry Met Sally. Obviously, the beat up car with the green mysterious object in the trunk was very Repo Man. Did anyone else notice anything that like reminded them of something that was a clear influence from something else?
I mean, I think you're right. I mean, I think you guys have both sort of mentioned at this point, but the Kubrick homages flow so fast and free this season, from the one you mentioned there of, you know, the Clockwork Orange to, you know, I believe it's the first time David enters the machine and we get that explicit 2001, you know, journey to the Star Child moment where we get the light show sparkling around us in a kaleidoscope manner.
I mean, I agree with you. Obviously, there's a huge Kubrickian influence, and that is pretty straightforward. I also thought of 2001 pretty frequently this season. But I was also sort of, I remain very taken by any time that there's an element of dance, and also how often the fight choreography looks vaguely dancey. If Legion all of a sudden became a musical, maybe that would be a way for me to get back fully
maybe
on, because that's my shit.
Yeah, and even the other ways, the other non-dance ways, they personify those psychic fights, like the scene where he's like old school wrestling Farouk. I thought was interesting, and then there's like they morph into like a tank firing into a cloud of dust. I thought was really cool. Yeah, I really like that. And then so sometimes it becomes a little disappointing when, like, as you know, I love Carrie, but like the fights. All right. Well, I mean, we've talked about the season as a whole, but I think we can probably get into our own individual picks. So let's talk about our best and worst episodes. Allison, what is your best and worst episode for the season?
So my favorite episode of the season is one that Alex has talked about a bit already. It's chapter 11, which I sort of call the virus rescue episode in my mind. God, I love episode titles. I want episode titles that mean things, that just every once in a while, that would be great. Anyway, I loved that episode. I thought it had an urgency that a lot of the rest of the season lacked. I think the first season, even though it sort of ran all over the place, there was this first deliberate need to escape, and then there was a mission that was time sensitive, and every episode had a goal, even if they didn't always make sense, and even if it didn't end up amounting to much, at least there was still some tension and drive and a reason to keep moving forward. I for all of the talk about the race to Farouk's body, I don't think the second season really achieved that. But I think it was absolutely the case in chapter 11, where David has to go into the mines first of Ptahnemy, and then, God, is it just the two of them? I guess it is. Anyway, he has to go into their minds and rescue them from the teeth-chattering virus that's been unleashed by the monk before finally arriving at a mind that he can't rescue. And the fact that it felt so much like a mission episode, that there was a clear goal, that we had to first get Ptahnemy and then get Melanie and find a way to recover from this situation where everyone and everything has stopped, where everyone and everything is in peril, I thought was really terrific. Very well acted. The sequence in Melanie's mind was especially haunting. It was great to actually see Ptahnemy do something. Like, that was very welcome. And anytime we get more Bill Irwin is good for me. So that is definitely my pick for number one. My least favorite episode of this season was the finale. Easily. And it's not close. So
my favorite episode this season was actually, for all the, you know, sort of shit we've been giving it this episode about, you know, needing to invest more in character and everything, I actually thought chapter 14 for me, which everyone can know as the one after David finds out that his sister is dead, where the entire episode is just, you know, different versions of David in different realities, or, you know, all in one sort of we do see the one shot where more than one of them are contained within that world, but, you know, we're basically, it's just him grieving, this idea of, you know, sort of conveying in this extremely abstract way the idea that you just, you know, your mind in these moments of intense grief is just trying to find any way to cope, and you're trying to escape, you're trying to retreat, you're trying to embrace it all simultaneously. I thought it was beautiful. I thought it was abstract Legion at its finest. So that would be my pick for the best of the season. And then, of course, the worst, you know, it's interesting, right up until we watched the finale, I would have said that chapter 12 was the worst, which is the one right after Allison's pick for the best episode, because I actually thought the one where he enters Sid's mind was quite weak, in the sense that that was the first time I felt like the show was trying to teach the audience something, as opposed to teaching of characters teaching each other something. It felt like it was geared more towards us than to David, and so I didn't really believe it. But yeah, then of course the ugliness of the finale sort of trumped it all.
I had the same reaction, Alex. Right up until the finale, I would have picked that Sid episode as the weakest of the season, because for the reasons you list, but also because it really felt like, look, we're developing Sid's character, when really it still ended up being entirely about David, and even then I'm not really sure what David learned. It really felt like wheel spinning, and it was very frustrating.
Since you guys already picked the finale for your worst episode, I'll go ahead and pick chapter 12 for my worst episode. I found it really unsatisfactory, and I was like, at first I was really excited to get a chance to learn a bit more about Sid, because as we said, like, she, along with most everyone else who isn't David and Aubrey Plaza, like, we don't really get to know a lot about them. But the story was really, I don't know, it felt really exploitative. It was yet another sort of, you know, sexual assault survival, like abuse survival storyline, mining tragedy and abuse for character development, especially for women. And it just was not good. And it was very, very tedious. But my favorite, I think I'm going to just still have to stick with the premiere. I don't think it's gotten better than the premiere, as much as I did really enjoy the virus rescue stuff and elements of other episodes. I just, nothing in this season beats that interpretive dance fight for me, in terms of like it being this that potent symbol of what, like, the best of what Legion can do for the superhero genre and superhero media, visualizing the inevitable action element of superhero stuff in different and unique ways. And it's just so much fun, but you also you feel the momentum and you see the progression of the fight and the conflict, and you know where everyone's at all times. And yet it still challenges you and delights you visually. I just thought it was great. And again, like, it still felt like we were reorienting ourselves to this new status quo with Division 3. I think that's the first episode where we see the little conveyor belt thing. Yeah, it's really great. That's my favorite episode. Go back to that, Legion, for season 3 if we end up watching it. Enough about episodes. Let's talk about the characters. We've already sort of, you know, talked a lot about the characters, but if we had to pick characters that aren't David, who would we pick as our MVP for the season? Alex, why don't you go first?
Sure. I've written a bit about this in the last couple of reviews when I was sort of trying to figure out what I thought about this season, but for my money, honestly, my MVPs of this season would be the Loudermilks, Bill Irwin and Amber Midthunder, in large part because even though they still remain just as underdeveloped as characters as everybody else, by maintaining their sort of sense of guilelessness, you know, their sort of earnest blank slate willingness to, which I think is sort of best demonstrated in that second to last episode, I believe it's second to last episode, might be the third to last, where they're sitting in the cafe at the Chinese restaurant having a conversation, and he's trying to tell, you know, Carrie is trying to tell Carrie that he's going to die someday. And I think it's because of that earnestness that there's that ability for us to still hold on to them as characters to relate to, as characters to understand, as providing a groundedness that nobody else on the show can give you. And as a viewer, that's, you know, that's an important thing to be able to hook into. And so there's such a joy to watch. They have such charisma together. I think both Midthunder and Irwin do spectacular work with seriously underwritten roles. So every time they show up, it's a joy for me.
I am so glad that you picked them. I also think pretty much any scene that was just the two Carries ended up being really successful, because at least they had a highly specific, really strange relationship with each other, and that relationship tends to shape how they perceive what's going on in the outside world, because they're so focused on care and concern for each other. There's a moment that's also in the whichever episode has them sitting at the Chinese restaurant, which is another scene I loved, where they're talking about death, and Carrie is talking about how eventually he's going to die, and Carrie says that that won't happen because she'll stab death twice in the heart, I think is the quote. And it was just the perfect mix of, like, funny and personal and unusual and upsetting, and I think that they are terrific. I love this pick.
Yeah, it's such a beautiful callback to one of my favorite moments of season one, where somebody asks Carrie, woman Carrie, to define their relationship, and she goes, "He makes me laugh, and I keep him safe."
Yeah, it's really great. No, I absolutely agree. I think one reason the Loudermilks work so well is they seem comparatively untouched by the more pernicious elements of this season's plotting. Like, they seem like they're part of the team, but they haven't had as much ripped from them by Farouk or Division 3. Like, they are, they're, and the, yeah, again, they get to be the most comparatively like the sunniest characters, which, you know, sounds weird considering all they've been through, but they're the ones that are able to maintain with a sense of humor and comradeship and love for each other. And if we're going down the line of like great Loudermilk scenes, I think I love that progression of trying to teach a female Carrie how to exist as an independent person and not just like take nutrients from her. So like she has to eat shumai for the first time. And also she has to learn how to poop. And he's trying to tell her how to poop through the door and how this whole thing works. And those moments of little comedy, like, they work so well, so much better than a lot of the other character dynamics in the show. Allison, what is your pick?
Oh, I'm going to go ahead and pick Aubrey Plaza and Lenny. For all of my frustration with the back half of this season, I think that Aubrey Plaza does the best job of anyone on the show, maybe except for Bill Irwin, who is a world-class, once-in-generation physical actor. If you've never fallen into a YouTube wormhole where you just Google Bill Irwin, I highly encourage you to do so. He's been doing clown work in the not creepy it sense, but in the high art physical comedy sense for decades and is a goddamn national treasure. So go look up Bill Irwin. But I think Aubrey Plaza's performance finds a way to take the visual world that Noah Hawley and company are creating and tie it to Lenny's experience. Every time that she's got a scene, particularly I'm thinking in the first half of the season, when David would sort of flit in and out of Farouk's mind and she was begging for an escape, there's that horrifying image of her attempting to shoot herself with the gun that then only blows bubbles, but she still falls. Those moments, I think, work in part because she's so committed to them. They never feel quite just like big visual statements. They always felt tied to what she was doing. And I think what happens in the back half of the season that does work is often tied to the fact that her performance is so specific and so emotional, even though it's rarely emotional in the sense that we typically think of it. It's not a Handmaid's Tale performance. It's definitely a Legion performance, but it's grounded in something that's always, to me, felt very real and human.
You know, it's kind of funny. I didn't realize until now that that's not the only bubblegum thing we get in a Marvel property this year. But yeah, no, I completely agree. Like, that's honestly, I kind of think that's the real pick is Aubrey Plaza, just because she absolutely runs away with every scene she's in. And like, it's also, you know, it kind of feels like she's the female character that Noah Hawley actually bothers to write.
Well, she was a male character at first, so there's always that.
Oh, well, there you go. Maybe that explains things. But, especially, I found it refreshing that she stayed interesting and cagey and curious even when she was divorced from Farouk. Like when she comes back to life, even in her new body, like, and, you know, she sort of honors that suggestion that Farouk says, you know, when he asks her, what are you going to do if you get to live again? And she's like, I'm going to live the shit out of life, basically. And so you get those scenes where, you know, she's just partying it up, but she's still not like racked with guilt necessarily, but there's like that specter of Amy still in there. And that's not necessarily well served, but she works well in those scenes. And yeah, it's just Aubrey Plaza, no matter what she's in, is always just a really magnetic presence. So I really like that.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, Legion has been such a showcase for her, and I agree completely. If there's an award to be given for, you know, performance this season, it would be to her. She's the Laurie Metcalf of this show.
Oh, no. Who's the Roseanne? My pick is, I mean, because honestly, if I had my druthers, I would have picked Lenny or the Loudermilks. But I think of the roster of remaining characters, I still have a soft spot for Oliver, Jemaine Clement's character. This season doesn't serve him all that great because he does still spend most of the time just hanging out with Farouk. And, you know, those scenes tend to just be like, oh, two well-dressed men just talking dryly about philosophy. He wears a suit very well. And the times when he's able to inject that wry Jemaine Clement sense of humor in, it's refreshing and it's a welcome bit of levity.
You, Alex, you made a great point in your finale review that I think ties both into why the finale was so frustrating, but also into part of what Jemaine Clement did so well this season, which was to talk about in the horrifying spectacle of David torturing Oliver, who may or may not actually be him, and we still don't know, and I don't really know, and who the fuck knows, but in that episode, as we're seeing what appears to be David torturing Oliver, that we understand, even though it's horrifying, because there's a point to it, because David is trying to save Sid. So there's this horrific thing happening, but there's a reason for it. And I think that using that as a comparison to what happens in the final act of the finale is a really useful point of comparison. But I think that those scenes work in part so well because what Jemaine Clement does is so specific. You never quite know who he's playing. Is this really Oliver, or is it Farouk, or is it David? And the way that his delivery shifts subtly throughout kept me, at least, on my toes in a way I found really engaging. And I think that's been true throughout this season. I was never quite sure who we were looking at when we were looking at Oliver, with the exception of the moment where he says he's going to kill Farouk, which was a big highlight of that episode for me. But yeah, I agree. Jemaine Clement, good at this job.
Yes.
Yeah, well, that's a good call out, because yeah, that allows me to give a quick moment of a consolation prize to Dan Stevens,
yeah.
who was asked to do the impossible this season, and really, I think, gave a stellar performance in the midst of, you know, being asked to do some of the most challenging stuff. I think it's probably possible.
Yeah, true. Yeah. Like, I think our criticisms, like, it's safe to say that our criticisms of David are levied at the character, not the performance. Like, I think Dan Stevens absolutely sells the shit out of it, and he's such an interesting combo of leading man and eccentric character actor that I think he was like the perfect choice to lead this show. Even the best actor in the world, I don't think, could like make the distasteful turns that David makes in those last episodes like really work. Yeah, it's a shame, but Dan Stevens, we love you, we just want David to be better.
I have exactly one Dan Stevens related complaint, and it is relatively minor, which is that I wish that his American accent were just a little better.
Every once in a while, maybe.
I'm like, oh buddy, you're trying so hard. But he is terrific throughout. He was terrific in the first season too. And the fact that his arc feels at all coherent, I think, is a testament to his performance.
Yeah, absolutely. He's able to sell that tragedy really nicely too. All right, well, let's wrap up with, instead of saying what our hopes are for season three, what would it take for us to come back to season three?
Oof. I mean, it's, you know, I have to say, it depends on what we mean by come back to season three, because for sure, I am going to tune in to see how they treat what they've done in this final episode. You know, whether that's one episode or two episodes, I can't promise I'll be there after that. But I'm genuinely curious to see how the hell they think they're going to come back from this.
Allison, what about you?
Well, I feel like maybe Legion is going to get filed away with American Horror Story for me now, where I'm certainly going to follow it. I don't know, as a civilian, if I'm going to look forward to Legion's return, whether or not I'm going to watch it recreationally, I guess. I will almost certainly be watching it professionally, because that's just a thing that's part of the job now, and it's a major television show, and there are some things it does really well. But when I say I want to file it in sort of the American Horror Story folder for me, is I think if I'm not either reviewing it, or I review it and then drop off for the rest of the season, I might wait until other people start to talk about whether what they're doing is interesting or not. I might just need to let somebody who's a little more devoted to the show than I am make that trudge and see what happens, because it's never fun to feel angry about something that you really liked. There are all kinds of TV shows out there, and there are some great ones and some other daring ones, and they treat their female characters in particular with more respect. So I will almost certainly be watching, but I might wait until Alex says, oh gosh, Legion has gotten really good again, before I dive back in earnest.
Yeah, as somebody who dropped off season two pretty quickly, and I looking back on it, I think maybe just the luster is gone for Legion for me a little bit, whereas as formally daring and aesthetically pleasing as it is, Like, I get to a certain point where I'm like, I get it, Legion. I get what you're doing, but you're not telling me anything new. So, yeah, I'll probably wait for other people who are more devoted to the show to, like, let me know if it's okay to come back inside. Yeah, so, I mean, that's Legion Season 2. It had quite a few bumps, but thanks so much for joining us. Where can people find you?
Thanks for having me. People can find me at the AV Club or on Twitter at AlexM247.
Excellent. All right, we'll move on. Whew, well, I'm exhausted from talking about Legion for 50 minutes.
It's hilarious because we actually did that like 6 hours ago. So we're peeling.
We're on
back
brand
the
with
curtain.
Legion. Yeah, playing around with time.
Little did you know that audio can be recorded at any time. So we recorded with Alex this morning, or recording with Dom now. And when you heard us talking about Legion, we were actually still just sitting here waiting only seconds to come back and continue our conversation.
Indeed, time is a flat circle.
Wait, Dom, are you still there? Were you fooled? Did you leave?
Oh, I'll take the wicker basket off his head.
Yeah, I've returned from the ether.
Great.
Okay, I've been falling for 6 hours.
All right, well, we're back.
I love that bit. I'm sorry. Ragnarok is so good. Anyway, okay.
Well, let's talk about our picks for next week. Allison, what are you looking forward to next week?
Oh, I am very excited about the return of Luke Cage. This is a little insidery, but to be totally fair and transparent, I have not yet started watching. But by the time you hear this, I will have, because I'm reviewing it for RogerEbert.com. You can look for it next week. Kate Kulsick will be reviewing it for us. You can find her review also next week. Anyway, I got the screeners for Luke Cage like 2 fucking months ago. And that says only one thing to me, which is that Netflix is very excited about season 2 of Luke Cage. I can't tell you the last time I got screeners. I got the first episode of The Handmaid's Tale like 4 months early, but it was one episode. The first episode of Harlots I got a couple of months early, but again, only one episode. So this is nuts to me. It's just insane. So I'm very excited about that coming back. This also marks the second... it will have already aired. Whatever, it doesn't matter. Whichever week you imagine that I am in, the next episode of Pose is a great one. Episodes 3 and 4 are both terrific. It's when, for my money, the show starts to get really interesting and start to do things that are a little more complicated narratively. It's also when you really get to see Billy Porter bust out the acting chops. Not that he hasn't been great already, but I'm very excited about that.
And Dominic Jackson. I think 3 and 4 is where she starts to actually get a little more to do, and so she doesn't feel as one note as they give her in the first 2 episodes. No, I totally agree.
We also spend some more time with Candy. You just see her sort of briefly whenever there's a scene with the House of Electra, because she's in the House of Electra. But she gets in episode 4, she shares a major storyline with Angel, and it's really, really great.
Really good show. Really good show so far. Dom, what are you looking forward to?
Well, to keep us on brand, I'm here to talk about wrestling again, but this is the most important kind of wrestling, because on TV Party previously, for those of you who listen regularly, I have talked about a show called Lucha Underground. For the first time, I can talk about it in a context where it's actually something you can currently watch on air. Its return episode aired this past week. The 4th season of it is now in progress. It is like nothing else on television. It is professional wrestling shot and performed like television, complete with interstitial skits, which are usually in ghastly looking bathrooms or backroom gymnasiums. They love to do those sets for some reason. And there are ninjas and there are undead beings and the supernatural Vince McMahon type who runs the temple where all the fighting takes place was recently disappeared for the 4th season and replaced in a twist by a relative of his who is played by the same actor in a wig and beard. It is one of my favorite things on television. It is on the El Rey Network every Wednesday, and I cannot recommend this enough. There are early seasons of it. I believe the first 2 are on Netflix now. So this is something you can catch up with, and it's something that is worth watching from the beginning, because sometimes wrestlers leave, at which point their characters are actually killed off in canon. Yeah, one guy left Lucha Underground as a company in real life, so in the show he was eaten. The point is, it's basically the inside of my brain as a wrestling television program. So I cannot...
See, now I need to watch it just to understand you better as a person.
You probably will. A guy got slammed onto a pizza during a match this week. Everything about it is good.
Was it a normal-sized pizza, or was it a large pizza?
I don't know, about average size for a pizza.
Okay. I just, for some reason, my initial thought was just like a giant, like, ring-sized pizza.
There was one time years ago where the Big Show, who is 7 feet tall and close to 500 pounds, pulled out an extra-large folding chair to use as a weapon because he needed his own Big Show chair. Wrestling's great, is my point.
Sounds good. Next week, I have a couple things I'm looking forward to that will bring me some happiness. First off, Drunk History is coming back for its summer premiere. It's like mid-season premiere. It's in the middle of season 5 right now. It's a show that, I mean, I've loved ever since it was Funny or Die sketches. And I was so ecstatic when the show actually came back to become a full series on Comedy Central. And I feel like it's been just gangbusters ever since. And the episode they're coming back with is called Heists. So combining Drunk History and heist stories, I'm all for. They're going to be talking about the Santa Bandits, the time this Italian janitor or something like that stole the Mona Lisa, and the story of Mossad agents like kidnapping Adolf Eichmann in, I believe, Argentina. I think some of the people who are going to be there, like Weird Al, Johnny Knoxville, some of the other like regulars on Drunk History. But so I'm looking forward to that. And then also, it's already out technically, but I haven't watched it yet, so it's in the future for me. The second season of Netflix's reboot of Queer Eye, which I found the first season to be really pleasant and life-affirming, even in that sort of hokey makeover show way. It's just really pleasant and positive and loving, and it's a nice warm hug of a TV show, so I'm really looking forward to that. So yeah, with those picks out of the way, that pretty much wraps up this episode of TV Party.
Let's do the damn thing.
Damn it, Becca.
Thank you so much for listening. You can find all of us individually at different places because we are different people. You can find me on Twitter at Allison Chu. You can also find my stuff at consequenceofsound.net, rogerebert.com, The AV Club, The Takeout, some other fine publications. And you can hear me on Podlander Drunkcast and Outlander Podcast, which is exactly what it sounds like. Clint, where can people find you?
You can find me on Twitter at AlcoHollywood. You can also find my podcastery and other film reviews and interviews and stuff at AlcoHollywood.com. And I podcast over at NathanRabin.com and my written stuff at Consequence of Sound.
Dom, where can people find you?
You can find all of my work at Consequences Sound also. I am also the host of the currently ongoing filmography podcast elsewhere on the Consequence Podcast Network. I feel like there should be a bell whenever I do like branded speech. I am currently wading through the filmography of Stanley Kubrick for some nice late summer reading. Our first episode is online now. Our second one will be arriving soon. And please give it a listen if you're so inclined.
And it will feature the both of us guesting on
your
show.
Yes, the next episode does feature both of you.
We had a nice late conversation about war.
War.
On the eve of the American president meeting with the North Korean dictator. It was great.
Hey, remember the time he was like, I want my people to stand for me.
I can't even wrap my mind around it. Remember that one time that we were tearing children away from their parents and throwing them into cages? Remember that?
Yeah,
anyway,
there's a reason I really need Queer Eye right now.
Yeah. Thank you again for listening. You can find us on Twitter at TV Party COS. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/TV Party Pod. If you have a question you'd like answered, you can reach out at TV Party@consequenceofsound.net.
You can leave us a review on iTunes, Podchaser, whatever your podcast platform may be. Please do it. We really appreciate it. And, you know, all the reviews help us so much. TV Party is a production of the Consequence Podcast Network. Check out our expanding roster of music, film, and television podcast programming at consequenceofsound.net.
This show is recorded and produced in Chicago, Illinois, and recorded and engineered by Clint Worthington, a lover of Queer Eye and a hater of entertainment.
Yes.
Violence. Thanks to Dom for being here. Thanks to you for listening. Thanks to Queer Eye for coming around when we need you. I don't know. That's it.
Till we meet again.